The Tom Woods Show, episode 459.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, just back from Washington, D.C., where I spent the weekend. I was the keynote speaker Saturday night, August 1st, 2015, at the Young Americans for Liberty National Convention. August 1st is my birthday, so you will note when I play for you the remarks I delivered at that event that the people in the audience sang happy birthday to me, so now you understand what is going on. It was a great time. I talked to them about progressives, you can see in the episode title here, and what they seem to be hearing when we talk. So I think it's a nice little presentation. I am leaving in the part about how I left my books back in the hotel, because I think there is a remark or two later in the talk that doesn't make sense unless you know that. So I'm going to play that for you now because I like it and because I just spent the weekend doing this and I'm tired and this is an easy episode. But it's also an episode that people I think would like to hear, and I always get asked, did they record it? And this time they actually did record it. YAL doesn't always do so, so I'm glad to be able to present this to you. One quick thing before I play this for you, I have become now a VIP affiliate of Bluehost, so if you are interested in starting that blog, starting that website that you've been meaning to get to, you can definitely be assured that you're getting the lowest pricing Bluehost has if you use my link. And I think it's only like 1% or 2% of their affiliates who can say this, so I'm really glad. TomWoods.com/blue. You'll always get the best pricing on web hosting. And of course, I have a step-by-step overview of how to do this. It's very, very easy, so there are no more excuses. Step-by-step overview at freewebsitebook.com. Check it out there and make sure and use my cheapo link, TomWoods.com/blue, to save yourself some dough. All right, here I am at the Young Americans for Liberty National Convention. Enjoy.
Please join me in welcoming Mr. Tom Woods.
Wow, thanks a lot. All right. Oh, it's a cupcake.
There's real gold on top.
Oh, that's very sweet. Oh, how nice. Thanks. All right. Yeah, last time they brought me out a whole cake, and I said, this time ain't no more. But they got me a nice cupcake. It's very nice. Well, listen, it's a real pleasure to be here. I actually have five daughters, it turns out. The Young Americans for Liberty can't even keep up with the child production going on in the Woods household. We have five of them. Two of them are seated right over here, Regina, age 12, and Veronica, age 10. Okay. All right, I have to tell you two quick things before I get into the subject matter for tonight. Did they print a topic for me in the program, or is it just say Tom Woods is talking about whatever? Did they give me a topic? Oh, they didn't? Oh, so I could change it, couldn't I? All right, but I think I'll stick with what I have, but... That actually is, it's good to know for the future. I can just come here and tell them any old story and then say what I want. All right, here's the thing. I came here from Kansas City with two suitcases full of books. And they're heavy and I'm lugging them around, but I'm used to it. I do it all the time. Forgot them back at the hotel. I haven't got any books. Nothing, no books whatsoever. So I'm going to tell you my room number and hotel names. You can follow me back there. No, 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 I won't do that. No, had bad experiences in that. However, as a consolation prize, I'm going to ask you to do me a favor. A lot of you folks have one of these, and I bet you there have been people who have told you to turn these things off during these sessions. No. Turn this on. I want you to turn it on right now. Turn them on. Yeah, that'll show you. Turn it on, and I'm going to give you a free book this way. It sounds contrived, like I forgot the books on purpose so I could show you my cool cell phone trick. But I honestly, it's killing me that I got to lug these things back. Anyway, text the word Liberty to 33444, and I will send you my free ebook called 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians Answered. And it covers things like sweatshops and the environment and drugs and guns, sort of things that your friends are badgering you about on Facebook all the time. And now you'll have all kinds of additional ammunition to use against them. And of course, I mean arguments to use against them. And you'll see them in this little ebook by texting Liberty to 33444. Isn't that liberating that I can do that? It's astonishing to me. All right. All right, so I won't dwell on the terrible tragedy of the missing books. I will talk instead, I'll tell you instead what it is that I'm planning to tell you. The topic I came up with was progressives. No booing yet? You've been here 3 days, you're exhausted already? There you go. Progressives hate what they think liberty is, not what it really is. Okay, now maybe they didn't put that in the program because that's so long and awkward, they didn't want to embarrass me by reproducing it. But in fact, the gist of this comes from something that I once heard Brian Kaplan say. He's a professor at George Mason University. And he says that, and I'm sure you'll all agree with me, that we seem to understand what progressives are saying much more than they understand what we're saying. We say hello, and they hear us saying, I hate the poor. Apparently some of you folks have had the same experience I've had. So I wanted to give some examples of this and talk a little bit about this, and maybe we can clarify with them a little bit what we mean. I think in some cases this is not a matter of people of goodwill who just mistakenly misunderstood what we were saying, but how come we understand them so well, but they just can't take the trouble to understand us? So for example, if we say something like, we don't believe in government funding of the arts, they hear that as, we don't think there should be arts. Or, I don't believe in government funding of X means we shouldn't have X. And it turns out that Frederick Bastiat already anticipated my talk today, 150 years ago, when he said this. Socialism, like the ancient ideas from which it springs, confuses the distinction between government and society. As a result of this, every time we object to a thing being done by government, the socialists conclude that we object to its being done at all. We disapprove of state education, then the socialists say that we are opposed to any education. We object to a state religion, then the socialists say that we want no religion at all. We object to a state enforced equality, then they say that we are against equality, and so on and so on. It is as if the socialists were to accuse us of not wanting people to eat because we do not want the state to raise grain. Ah, indeed. Just when you think you have a fresh new idea, you realize Bastiat stated it more eloquently than you could have a century and a half ago. All right, that's okay. No need to reinvent the wheel. However, insights like this occasionally can stand to be updated in light of current circumstances. So, for instance, in 2013, shortly after the death of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, the following text appeared all over Facebook, superimposed over an image of Margaret Thatcher. And they really thought they were letting Margaret Thatcher have it by saying this. On Wednesday, 17th April 2013, I will be kind. I will give money to charity and my time to someone who needs my help, because, you know, Margaret Thatcher wouldn't have wanted you to do that. I will smile at strangers, because Margaret Thatcher was against smiling at strangers. That was a big part of her platform. And hold open the door for others. Again, if Thatcher stood for anything, it's slamming the door in the face of someone holding groceries. That was her big thing. I will make a donation to my local food bank. Well, we all know Margaret Thatcher wanted to set food banks on fire. We know that was a big part of her platform. I will make an appointment to give blood. Well, of course, we know Margaret Thatcher would suck blood. We know that. And then it goes on to say, I will do this because I believe in society, and I can think of no better way to overcome the legacy of a leader who did not. Okay. I don't even need to elaborate on this at this point. They actually think that that's what Margaret Thatcher was saying. Now, whatever differences we may have with Margaret Thatcher, she wasn't saying any of these things. She was not implying you shouldn't donate blood. She wasn't implying you shouldn't donate food, donate your time, donate money, do good deeds, hold doors open. Her point was that there may be a more civilized way for human beings to interact with one another than by pointing a gun at each other's heads and ordering us to do things for each other, that maybe these things ought to come spontaneously from the affection that we feel for other human beings. That was her point, and she even said that. She said that there is no such thing as society, and that's, they leave the quotation off there.
She doesn't think there's a society.
What she means is society isn't an entity. Society can't do good deeds. Only the individuals who compose society can do good deeds. And so that's what we need to do as individuals, as decent human beings. We need to do these things spontaneously. That was her point. And they really thought, well, we'll show her on this day. We're all going to be nice people. She would have been saying bravo to that. All right, that's the first thing. That, to me, that has shocked me for years, since that came out, that there were people who thought that that was Margaret Thatcher's message. But this problem of misunderstanding our message goes back. It's not just something that's occurred over the past 2 years or 10 years or 50 years or 100 years. At the very least, it goes back to the birth of socialism, modern socialism in the 19th century. Because we would say free market. And what they would hear is anarchy of production. We say, yeah, right. We say, woo, yeah, I hear anarchy of production. I say, yeah. Alas, not everyone thinks as you and I do. But when we say free market, it is true that we mean a system in which there is no one person running everything. There's no one person assigning jobs to everybody. There's no one person allocating resources across the board or saying how much of something should be produced or what should be produced or where it should be produced or how it should be produced. So superficially, that would seem like an anarchy. There would be chaos that would result from this. And yet we're surrounded by all the testimony to the contrary that you could possibly ask for. An extraordinary array of goods in quantities that are exactly what is demanded by the public, with no person in charge of this. And this is the reason that a great many of us are so interested in this cause, because it amazes us that this is possible. This happens spontaneously. That somehow voluntary interaction can give rise to a system of prices that can help coordinate human activity to the point where we don't need one person or one central planning board in charge. And what's interesting is that the exact opposite, as usual, is in fact the truth. The real anarchy of production comes when you have a central planning agency. And I realize that that is, I almost don't blame people for having trouble seeing this, because that is contrary to what you would expect. You would think that if we have a group of people and they're really smart, and they sit down there with clipboards, they should be able to plan out the economy very effectively, much more so than everybody just doing whatever he wants. And yet this is one of the great achievements of Ludwig von Mises. One of the 8 reasons he should have won the Nobel Prize was his analysis of pure socialism. If you have a central planning board and the state owns the means of production, then there's no buying and selling of the means of production. Whether it's lumber or steel or factories or assembly line equipment or whatever, all the things that go into making consumer goods, if the state owns them all, there's no buying or selling. If you owned everything in the world, you wouldn't buy or sell. You already own everything. If the state owns all the means of production, there's no buying and selling. And if there's no buying and selling, there are no prices, because that's where prices come from, the interaction of buyers and sellers. And if there are no prices, the central planning board has no idea how to arrange resources in a way that's not destructively uneconomic. It has no way of knowing how to produce things in a way that satisfies consumers and is least wasteful. How does it know? Well, here's a production process that could be mostly lumber or mostly steel. They have no idea which one to use. They don't know which one is in greater demand elsewhere, et cetera. They have no way of doing that. So all their decisions are totally arbitrary. That's an anarchy of production. So the exact opposite is the truth. Or how about we favor the free market and they hear survival of the fittest, right? You get that all the time. Oh, you just want the poor to die off. If I wanted the poor to die off, I would want them to have socialism and I would want them to have the pre-capitalist system that existed because they were dying off. That's what makes capitalism so glorious. Why else are people flocking to the factories in the 19th century? Why are they flocking to factories if the conditions are as bad as everyone says they were? Well, of course, they were terrible. But their other alternatives were worse. And this is why it does not help the poor to look down the list of their options and cross out the one they actually chose. Their next option will be worse. Now, in terms of survival of the fittest, of course, capitalism has allowed, made possible the pure survival of far more people than anyone ever dreamed possible. If you look back to classical Athens and classical Roman civilization, even then you can find people griping about overpopulation when the population was like 2% of what it is now or something. They couldn't have dreamed that the world could support this many people in reasonable comfort. But this has, in fact, happened under so-called survival of the fittest economics. In fact, one of my favorite responses to the allegation that we believe in survival of the fittest comes from George Riesman, who is, I think he's in his early 80s by now, and he is as productive as he ever was. And he says, totally unlike lions in the jungle, who must compete for a limited supply of animals such as zebras and gazelles by means of the power of their senses and limbs, producers under capitalism are in competition for a limited supply of dollars in the hands of consumers, which they compete for by means of offering the best and most economical products their minds can devise. Since such competition is a competition in the positive creation of new and additional wealth, there are no genuine long-run losers as a result of it. There are only winners. He goes on to say, the competition of farmers and farm equipment manufacturers enables the hungry and weak to eat and grow strong. That of pharmaceutical manufacturers enables the sick to recover their health. That of eyeglass and hearing aid manufacturers enables many who otherwise could not see or hear to do so. So far from being a competition whose outcome is the survival of the fittest, the competition of capitalism is more accurately described as a competition whose outcome is the survival of all, or at least of more and more for longer and longer and ever better. The only sense in which only the fittest survive is that it is the fittest products and the fittest methods of production that survive until replaced by still fitter products and methods of production, with the effects on human survival just described. Now we say, keep what you earn. The progressive hears inequality. Well, inequality is probably, if your experience is similar to mine, the most frequently heard complaint about what they take to be market economics these days. And I want to answer some of that. Because that comes up a lot. You want to know what to say about that. And I guess my flippant answer of so freaking what is probably not too helpful. So I got some numbers here. I got some figures for you. Let's think about the condition of the poor. Because really, we would all admit that if we had a society where the rich man has 10 yachts and the poor man has only 7 yachts, we could probably just quit worrying about it at that point. So let's look at the condition of the poor. What do the bottom 10% of any society earn? Let's look at that question. It turns out that no matter what country you live in around the world, chances are the bottom 10%, if you belong to the bottom 10%, then collectively you're going to earn around 2.6% of that country's total income. But what share of income does that actually amount to? What does that actually mean in terms of dollars in the poor person's pocket? dollars in the pocket of somebody who's in the lowest 10%. Well, the latest figures that I have are from 2011. And we've had a number of these studies where they look at free countries, relatively speaking, and less free countries, relatively speaking, in terms of economic freedom. And in the less free countries, if you were in the lowest 10%, then on average you were earning $932 a year. But if you belong to one of the freer countries, you earn $10,556 per year. So you earned, in other words, more than 10 times more just because you lived in a society that had more economic freedom. So if what you're really concerned about is the advancement of the poor, you should favor economic freedom. Whereas if what you really care about is depriving rich people of things they have, then you could try something else. But you won't have the results that our side of things can show. How about something you learn about in typical college economics textbooks? Gini coefficients, by which inequality is often measured. So if you have a perfectly equal income distribution, the Gini coefficient is zero. All right, well, it turns out that if you look at the 25 freest countries, and you pit them against the 25 least free countries, the freer countries have a lower Gini coefficient than the unfree. How about that? Then not too long ago, now to console me that I left these books that it's so heavy to lug them through that airport, and I left them in the hotel room. To console me, please tell me you'll subscribe to my podcast on iTunes or something, because in my podcast, thank you. You know, it's a birthday present. It costs you nothing, okay? TomWoods.com is my website where you can do that. But one of the people I had on the show some time ago is a professor named Deirdre McCloskey. And one of the ways that she's dealt with this whole inequality question is to talk about what she calls the Great Enrichment, a period from, you know, maybe the second quarter up through the end of the 19th century, into the 20th century, and going up through the 20th century. And she says that during these last couple of centuries, the world population has increased by a factor of six. But despite this rise in population, the amount of goods and services consumed by the average person has not fallen. As a matter of fact, the amount of goods and services produced by the average person on Earth has risen since 1800 by a factor of 8.5. So she invites us to consider what that means. We now have 8.5 times on average, 8.5 times as much food, clothing, housing, education, travel, and books for the average person, even though there are 6 times as many of them. Moreover, up until the period that she calls the Great Enrichment, the average income per capita daily in the world was $3 a day. And that's in, you think of it as three actual dollars in your pocket. I'm talking about that amount of purchasing power. Try and think of how you would feed, clothe, and house yourself on $3 a day. You probably couldn't do it. You'd have to obviously produce a lot of your own food. You'd have to produce a lot of, I mean, it would be impossible. You could barely participate in the division of labor at all. You'd be lucky to survive. I'd be gone in a week. I don't know how to do anything. I can't grow anything. I can't fix pipes. Like, I don't know anything. I can't do anything. I can come up here and speak to you, and that's it. That would be the end of me. $3 a day. Today, even if we average in the poorest countries in the world, where if they didn't live under such oppressive and horrifying regimes, they would be much richer. Even if we include them, the amount has increased by a factor of 11. Nothing like that has ever occurred in the history of the world. It's $33 a day now. Now, even in the United States, where we've come to expect a higher standard of living than that, I bet on $33 a day, you could figure out some way to survive. That's what matters. That's what matters. We've just had the most staggering increase in the standard of living of the most vulnerable people in the world. And we're worried that a few people have yachts and private planes. That is morally perverse. That has to come from ignorance. That has to come from the fact they just don't know this. And if some of you folks, if you listen to me frequently, you'll know I'm very fond of this example, but it's a great example. from Ludwig von Mises. Mises said that we can think about inequality in the following way. Think about the difference between rich and poor 500 years ago. Okay, the difference between rich and poor 500 years ago is that the rich person is traveling in a coach driven by four horses. The poor person is lucky to have a pair of shoes. That's absolutely true. Lucky to have a pair of shoes to be able to walk on foot. Today, you have the rich man having a fancy car and the poor man having a beat-up car. But they both have a car, which is a contrivance no one could have dreamed of 500 years ago. I mean, well, maybe Leonardo da Vinci dreamed of something like that. But the point is, this is what matters. Now they can both get around in a car. In fact, back in Stalinist Russia, when Stalin wanted to promote anti-capitalist propaganda, he encouraged showing the film version of The Grapes of Wrath that you all had to read in school and you hated every page of it. Because there's a section in there where Steinbeck goes off on the evils of farm equipment because it throws people out of work. And you just think, yeah, I'd like to throw this book right out the window. That was a cheap one. No. You're just encouraging me with applauding for that. But anyway, in that movie, of course, you see this, you know, this family and, you know, the Jodes are desperately poor. But in the movie, they have a car and the Russian audience is blown away. This family has a car. So it has the exact opposite of the intended effect. They were supposed to say this family is suffering under capitalism, but even the poor people seemed like they were doing pretty well by Russian standards. So these things are also worth mentioning. Now, there's a lot more that can be said on the inequality subject, and I feel like I should do one or two episodes devoted exclusively to this, because there are a lot more interesting statistics about the mobility between different income quintiles. It's not like the lowest 10% is a fixed group. Like you come into the earth and they just tattoo on your forehead, lowest 10, and you're just stuck there. There's actually tremendous mobility from one group to another. Or how about this one? We say the New Deal didn't work in the 1930s. And they hear, you want to be like Herbert Hoover who did nothing. Now, this is wrong on so many levels, right? Now, in this room, I am glad that I would think most of you know that the story of Herbert Hoover that we all got in school is just a big, fat, nothing lie, right? It's just nothing to it. I mean, we have the deficits by Hoover as a percentage of GDP rivaled Franklin Roosevelt's deficits. He spent more on public works than had been spent in two or three decades before him. He cracked down on immigration, on short selling. He increased taxes on practically everything you can imagine, even toiletries. He established the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to bail out failing railroads and banks. He made his best effort to force up wages at a time when people are losing their jobs. They can't support employment at the current wage level. He intervened in agriculture. It was just one thing after another, the Smoot-Hawley tariff, one thing after another, all different forms of intervention. And he himself said that, you know, we could have done nothing, but instead we launched the greatest program of economic reconstruction in the history of the Republic. What I find interesting about this, however, is the way this is all spun by Paul Krugman and Brad DeLong being from Berkeley. Both of these economists, who at one time or another have taught at elite universities, DeLong is still at Berkeley, have both written newspaper columns or blog posts in which they have said that we look in Hoover's memoirs and we see Andrew Mellon, the Treasury Secretary, saying we've got to liquidate labor and liquidate this and liquidate that. And they say, you see, that's what Hoover did. He just let everything go down the toilet. And there it is, right in his memoir. Now, sometimes when people are just, uninformed, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt and I say, look, you know, you can't know everything. I don't know everything. People in this audience don't know everything. Everybody makes a mistake once in a while. But I find it hard to believe that that could be a mistake, because on the very next page, and I mean facing page, like you don't even have to go to the physical effort of turning a page. I mean the facing page, Hoover says, well, thank goodness we didn't take that advice. All right. So he says that. He says, we didn't do any of that. That's what Mellon wanted me to do, but of course, I didn't do that. That's the part they leave out. They leave that part of the quotation out. But that part of the, that's the whole thing. Like, that's it, right? That's, we didn't do this. Well, how many people in America do you think are going to go back and check Hoover's, they're going to get their copy of Hoover's memoirs off the shelf and look it up for themselves? So these people are systematically misleading the public for political purposes. That's wrong. That's seriously wrong. So I am pleased to tell you, if you haven't heard already, about a little project that I have coming up next month. Don't know the exact date, but I have a podcast idea. This one is just going to be weekly. Right now I'm releasing 30 minutes of libertarian coolness every weekday. Thank you. I have these guests who can just carry the show. Like I can take a shower, come back, you know, Walter Block's still talking. It's great, works out great. But this show is going to be once a week. It's going to be economist Bob Murphy and me. And the idea is every single week, we're going to refute Paul Krugman's New York Times column. Until one of us dies. Okay. All right. All right. Hold that pose. Keep doing that. I want Murphy to see the enthusiasm for this. All right. All right. Thank you. And the show is going to have a very simple name, four syllables, so that you'll know immediately what it's about. It's just called Contra Krugman. And the thing is that Krugman, as personally, I just happen to know, is so vain that even though he knows, obviously, he's never going to persuade us, and, you know, we cater to a different audience than he does, it's still going to get under his skin so much that there's a whole show dedicated to refuting him. I don't think there is such a podcast anywhere in the world that's just dedicated to... Now, you may say, but Woods, why are you giving Krugman all this attention? The answer is, first of all, he personifies Keynesianism in America, like it or not. But secondly, he has millions of readers who are being, I was going to say brainwashed, misled. Let's be kind. They're being misled by this guy every single week. But also, there are people who will listen to a show called Contra Krugman who would never listen to my show. There are people out there in the GOP who know they don't like Paul Krugman, but they don't know Mises. They don't know Hayek. They don't know Rothbard. They don't know Austrian economics. So they know they don't like Paul Krugman. But then we can teach them the whole shebang, you know, that here's real live economics. Like here's how you can understand things. So I'm really looking forward to that. And this way, when Krugman tries to pull the old Hoover liquidated everything trick, bang, bang, we come right back 5 minutes later with this show. It's going to be a lot of fun. All right. All right, what else can we talk about here? Lots of things that progressives hear us say that we never said and would never in a million years think of saying. Let's look at another one. How about, all right, I'm going to pick deregulation. That's a big one. They don't like deregulation. I have a book called Rollback that has a long section on why deregulation is not responsible for the financial crisis. I'm never going to earn back the money I got for the advance for that book. So I earn nothing by any additional sales on that book. So I'm not trying to make myself rich telling you about it. And if you knew how much money authors made, you'd actually sit here and cry for me. So you wouldn't even be worried. But that has the whole story. Here, I'm just going to focus on one episode that all you folks are too young even to remember. But your parents remember it, and it has colored their views on regulation ever since. And that is the SNL problem. The SNL debacle of the 1980s. These were savings and loan institutions, and the conventional wisdom was the savings and loans were chugging along just fine, and then the crazy old free market people got in charge and deregulated everything, and then they all collapsed. Now, that is not really what happened, but I bet before my even telling you that, even if you knew nothing about this, I bet you all knew, because we've all had this happen so many times, that wasn't the real truth of what happened. right? We've all heard this a million times. Anytime somebody says, well, we had the free market and look what happened, it's always like, you know, they're picking like France as their example of the free market. Like, I don't think that's fair. It's a bad example. All right, so here's what was actually going on. The SNLs, actually, the deregulation of the savings and loan institutions began under Jimmy Carter, as did a lot of deregulation. Transportation, energy, oil. So they all want to blame this on Reagan. Well, go ahead. Blame wouldn't be the word. These things worked out great. Airline deregulation? That's great. I mean, fares are much lower now. The Civil Aeronautics Board was an evil, evil monopoly institution anyway that should have been abolished. Because for the longest time, I wasn't planning to talk about this, but I talk about the Civil Aeronautics, but some things you just have to get outraged about, right? They used to have this system where if you were a brand new competing airline, they wouldn't actually let you really compete with the big boys. They wouldn't let you have fixed schedules. So you were actually called the non-skeds. You had no schedule. You would just be able to tell people, we're going to fly from Washington to Los Angeles on Thursday. So show up, and when the plane fills up, we'll take off. Like, they had to do this. And we laugh and think, who would live in a world like that? Your parents lived in that world. The world of the non-skeds. This was for your own good, of course. This was not to allow the big airlines to be able to charge higher fares because they could actually have schedules. Absolutely not. That was for your safety. Now, and on what conceivable grounds that could be for your safety, I you know, you have to make something up. But they got rid of that. All right, anyway. Well, so the SNL deregulation actually began under Jimmy Carter. But the long and the short of it is the SNLs were making mortgage loans to people. And they could charge 5% maximum on mortgage loans. They could offer depositors 3%. So as long as those numbers made sense, they could make a profit. Depositors really had nowhere else to go in those days because the friendly government had put a cap on how much interest payments banks could offer on savings accounts. That's also for our own good, making sure we don't earn enough on our savings. They're doing a great job of that today, by the way. They used to have to do it by law in the old days, keep it down to 3%. But then the money market mutual fund pops up, and people don't have to be satisfied with a crummy 3% return with the SNLs. So they start taking their money out of the SNLs. But the government requirement is still that, sorry, you can only offer 3%. Then, meanwhile, the deposit interest rate requirements become unrealistic under the interest rate regime of the early 1980s, where interest rates were extremely high, but the SNLs can charge only 5%. So they're getting squeezed on both ends. Now, of course, the correct solution would be to say, we shouldn't have government husbanded institutions that have some form of deposit insurance, that have moral hazard, that have restrictions and rules set by government bureaucrats. Why don't we just let mortgage loans be dealt with on the free market entirely? And depositors get whatever savings interest rate a bank is willing to give them. What about that crazy system? So the so-called deregulation was basically saying, all right, well, you know, you can offer, you can make more mortgage loans at more reasonable rates, and you can offer this or that. Obviously, what should have happened is they should have said, this whole system is coming apart, and it has had government encouragement. We're going to take that out. We're going to take out any insurance of your deposits, and we're just going to see if you sink or swim on your own. That, of course, should that would have been deregulation. Let these institutions compete genuinely on the free market. But instead, we had this government-established institution with government-established rules, with its money guaranteed by the government, and we're told that was deregulation and it failed. But it didn't. It didn't. That was not deregulation. But that's always what so-called deregulation winds up. It's never real deregulation. It's comparable to what happened in the Soviet bloc countries. They didn't have full-fledged privatization. What wound up happening was socialism is abolished, and instead the bureaucrats who were running the old system start running the companies. That's privatization. Well, no wonder in Eastern Europe they don't like privatization if they think that's what it is. They think this jerk who was lording it over me under communism now gets the firm? Well, that doesn't, you know, then I guess I don't like the free market. And by the way, Rothbard and others wrote some great stuff about what should be done. How should desocialization have occurred? when the government owns everything and then a new regime comes in, they topple the old one, how do you distribute the property? I mean, maybe you should assume that all the people are shareholders of it or something. I mean, just distribute it equitably in some way. And if you really feel like you should have equality, that would be a path to equality. And what's interesting is that if you look at all the journal articles, if you look at you look in vain, for example, for a Heritage Foundation backgrounder on what's going to happen when communism collapses. What kind of policy should we have when we have all this collectively owned property? How should we distribute it to private agents? You won't see that really, and I don't mean to pick on the Heritage Foundation. The point is no one expected communism to fall. So instead they were thinking about, well, how can we have a strategic nuclear defense against the Soviet Union, and how can we, you know, what if we launch this missile and then they'll launch that one? No one bothered to sit down and write any policy studies about what happens when their system collapses. How do they liquidate and go to a market society? No one wrote anything on it. No one. No one wrote anything on it. And they should have, because they should have listened to Mises, who said that a genuine, full-blown socialist system will come down. They didn't believe it. A lot of people who said they believed in freedom didn't really believe their own message, didn't really believe that a command system has to meet that type of unfortunate end. Finally, you say decentralization, and they hear slavery and oppression. Now, it's true that states in the United States enforced the system of slavery. We should expect nothing less. They are states. They do horrifying things. They do that for a living. That's their job. But when we look at the whole collective history of the world, and we look at how minority populations have fared in large-scale empires, it's not always good. Now, I suppose the minorities in the Austro-Hungarian Empire fared fairly well. That's true. But how did they fare in the Ottoman Empire? Well, I'm half Armenian, and 1.5 million of them were killed. How did the Ukrainians, how did they do in the Soviet Union? Well, horrifying, right? 5 to 6 million of them were starved to death, even though they have some of the most fertile soil on the whole continent. And one could go down the line. I don't even need to bring Hitler into the question, because that example is so obvious. In fact, here I go, bringing Hitler in. In fact, if you read Mein Kampf, which I don't really recommend, by the way, so I'm just going to tell you, if you look in there, he has a whole passage in there about how we can't have anything like states' rights here because we are one people. We should all be doing the same darn thing. Well, I'm sorry, but I do hear. Now, I'm not saying progressives are Hitler. Let me just make that clear. A lot of these are perfectly nice people, right? Some of them are in our own families. We're not saying that they're Hitler. We're saying that it should give them pause that they're making exactly the same arguments. Well, of course, we have to have one policy. One policy for all. But stop. Stop. Yeah, I know that's starting to have a German accent when you talk that way. Think about, I mean, again, I can give many examples of minorities being treated horribly by centralized states. But they've been treated badly by states, period. In fact, I think this may be the worst of the state's crimes when we look at the way the state has treated minorities over the years. All right, so what is the benefit of decentralization? The benefit is that even if some local area does something stupid, at least it's not the whole country doing something stupid. Worst case scenario, you could move away. And it's for this reason, there are a number of historians, there's a whole school of historical thought that argues that the reason that Western civilization enjoys liberty today is that we didn't have a replacement for the Roman Empire. We didn't replace one empire for another. We had Charlemagne's short-lived empire, but that more or less dissolved. Instead, what happened, and continuing on into the early modern period, is we had a wide variety of political jurisdictions, a tremendous variety, tremendous decentralization. And they took all different forms. We had kingdoms, it's true. We had bishoprics, we had margraves, we had free cities, we had institutions within these localities that had their own rights, like universities and guilds that couldn't be trampled on. You had all these different jurisdictions. And it's because there wasn't one entity that could impose stupid policies on everybody, that kept the political leaders restrained. Because they know that if I become unreasonable, these poor souls can just go 5 feet away to the next jurisdiction. And that's why F.A. Hayek said that liberty is most likely to flourish in a world of small states. Now, I know that there are some people in this room who probably feel like there should be no states at all. But bear in mind that the next best solution to that is not to have one giant state, because one is really close to zero, right? And even two states, well, still two, right? I mean, it may be close to zero, but if it can't be zero, it may as well be 10,000, because at least you have these restraints that are imposed. So the point is, there are good reasons to believe in decentralization. And moreover, why should Vermont have to live the same way Alabama lives? Let them have their, I mean, if we really believe in diversity and let 100 flowers bloom and let everybody live the way he wants to live, why does everybody have to be like Alabama or everybody have to be like Vermont? Why don't you just say, mind your own business, you live your way, I'll live my way, and if I think you're wrong, I will do my best to persuade you of it. That's really what our message fundamentally is. And what gets to me, and this is how I'll wrap up, is that the progressives somehow got the word progressive. You know, we had the word liberal taken from us. And by the way, we're obviously terrible at stealing words from people. We just sit there, we're having a party. Meanwhile, people have got like a wheelbarrow full of our words they're carting away. So we're no good at this. So I'm not saying we should try to get progressive. Like, that ain't going to happen, right? No one's even going to understand what we're talking about. But progressive, you would think it would have to have something to do with progress. But look at what it really amounts to. I mean, for example, I gave you that statistic, very interesting statistic, about $3 a day versus $33 a day. Now, back with the $3 a day thing, you could imagine a progressive saying that the solution to this situation is to find those people who are earning $4.25 a day and take their extra $1.25 and distribute it. We would still be earning $3 a day if that had been the solution. The reason we've been able to progress, as George Reisman says, is that the redistributors were beaten back hard enough and long enough to allow prosperity to emerge. We did the exact opposite of what a progressive would do. And the results are everywhere. There has never been a greater conquest of poverty in the history of the world. If you look at the statistics for the United States alone in the 20th century, we see the lowest quintiles purchasing power increasing by a factor of between 10 and 20. That's astonishing. Nothing like that has ever, no one could have dreamed that something like that could have happened. When you look at the amenities the average person enjoys, it's far greater than the most prestigious names in European history could have enjoyed. So there's no disputing this. It seems to me this one we win. And if you look around the world and you say, oh, what about the Scandinavian countries? I have whole episodes on the Scandinavian countries, but that example doesn't work either. If you look at the net number of private sector jobs created in Sweden during the period of their welfare state up through the 1990s, it's zero. Oh, there's a great model for the world. Let's go copying that. But they skip over that part, the number of net private sector jobs, which is kind of an important number. You want to support people. You need jobs for them. But this is a winner. You look around the world, you look at where are people suffering the fewest deprivations materially. It's always in the countries where there is at least some deference to our ideas. Think about societies of old. They were based on caste. They were based on birth, and you could only go so far as your birth would allow you to go. One of the great progressive advances by classical liberalism was to have a society that was based on contract, that you could go as far as you want. There is no limit on where you can go. And we interact with each other not on the basis of you are good Duke so-and-so, and I'm a mere peasant, but that you are an individual and I am an individual and you and I can enter into contracts that benefit us both. That is a tremendous epoch-making advance. Every single thing we stand for is an advance toward progress. Peace is what makes prosperity possible, and we believe in peace for all the reasons that make sense. Not just because it's sweet and wonderful, but because we value life, we value human cooperation. And that is really why, when it comes down to it, so many of us are interested in economics. That's not just a coincidence that so many of us are interested in economics. Like, why aren't we all interested in art history? Like, why is it economics in particular? Now, I just went to the National Gallery of Art today, by the way. So, I am cultured to some degree. But isn't it interesting that you get in a room like this and two-thirds of us are interested in economics? It's because we're interested in the phenomenon of social cooperation and how it happens spontaneously. This is our whole... So when you listen to our message, it is the most progressive message of all. We really are the true progressives. And they're not hearing what we're saying. Maybe that means we need to say it a different way. Maybe it means we need to say it more loudly. But we certainly need to keep on saying it in blogs, in videos, in public speaking. There are ways now that for free or very little cash, you can become good and better and outstanding at all of those things. We are still very much a minority, so we can't afford to have each of you be one person. Each of you has to be three people in terms of the knowledge you have and the skills that you have. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're all in this together. Go out there and acquire those skills. Stick with Young Americans for Liberty. And here's to progress, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much. All right, everybody. The show notes page for today is tomwoods.com/460. I'll link to a couple of things, I suppose. I'll think of something. Probably link to Rollback, because I mentioned that book in this talk. But link to a few things that are relevant to help you get a little bit more out of this particular episode. Also, tomorrow, we're going to welcome Kevin Gutzman back to the show. It turns out that the Democratic Party of Connecticut and at least one other state, they've decided to drop the names Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson from their annual dinner. And we're going to talk about that. Is this a good decision on their part? And we'll talk about that from the point of view of, do these people represent the Democratic Party? And also, were these people good people? Is Thomas Jefferson one of the good guys? Is Andrew Jackson one of the good guys? Well, it turns out we're going to say yes to one and no to another and explain why. So you'll definitely want to hear that tomorrow. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.